Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From the UN Climate Summit in Dubai, here in the United Arab Emirates, this is Democracy Now!
There were 30 people inside the house. 20 of them were children. We went to sleep. All of a sudden, what happened to us, we don't know. The fire hit us, and like you see, all of it collapsed on top of us.
Israel's attack on Gaza is now being described as one of the worst assaults on any civilian population in recent times, as Israeli tanks drive deeper into Khan Yunis, and the Palestinian death toll tops 16,000. We'll go to Gaza for the latest. Then here at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai, Democracy Now! Attempts to question the UAE oil CEO who's presiding over the climate talks. Can you answer a question from the press? Dr. Al-Jaber, can you tell us why there are 2,500 fossil fuel lobbyists here? Dr. Al-Jaber, can you tell us if there should be a fossil fuel phase out? We'll get an update on the UN Climate Summit and look at how the UAE is buying up land across Africa as part of an initiative called Blue Carbon. And we'll speak to a leading Russian environmentalist as Vladimir Putin visits the UAE and Saudi Arabia today. All that and more coming up. To Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates from the UN Climate Summit. These are the headlines. In Gaza, Israeli tanks are pushing further into the southern city of Khan Yunis as its deadly ground assault continues and Palestinian casualties rise. The few functioning hospitals remain completely swamped with an influx of injured people, many of them children. The WHO called the assault on Gaza, quote, humanity's darkest hour. At least 16,200 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed since October 7th. The UN's top humanitarian relief coordinator said Israel's attack in southern Gaza has been as devastating as in the north, with the apocalyptic conditions preventing the delivery of aid. Some 85% of the Gazan population has now been displaced.
We suffered from the war of cannons and escaped it to arrive at the war of starvation. Now we cannot find food. We make the food by ourselves. We divide one tomato between all of us. There is no safe place. They finish off one place at a time, and only God knows where we will end up. Are we going to be alive? Are we going to be martyrs? We do not know what our destiny is. Today I eat, but I do not know if I'm going to eat tomorrow.
Meanwhile, an Israeli military spokesperson appeared on CNN Tuesday and touted a report released this week which said the IDF killed some 5,000 Hamas fighters, which would equal roughly two civilians killed for every Hamas member.
You will find that that ratio is tremendous, tremendously positive and perhaps unique in the world.
The comments were swiftly condemned, and the accuracy of the figures have apparently not been verified outside the Israeli military. The Biden administration announced Tuesday it would ban visas for Israeli settlers involved in surging West Bank violence. Israeli soldiers and settlers have killed at least 260 Palestinians and wounded over 3,000 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since October 7th. The U.S. government's rare rebuke of Israel comes as the Senate is voting today on a $106 billion spending package, which would send more military funding to Ukraine and Israel. Senate Republicans vowed to block the package over its lack of funding for so-called border security. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders spoke out against the bill on the Senate floor Monday.
I do not believe we should be appropriating over $10 billion for the right-wing extremist Netanyahu government to continue its current military approach. What the Netanyahu government is doing is immoral, it is in violation of international law, and the United States should not be complicit.
Despite his condemnation of Israeli violence, Sanders has refused to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. 13 House Democrats and one Republican, Congressmember Thomas Massie, voted against a new resolution explicitly equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism Tuesday. 92 Democrats voted present. The resolution also states the phrase "from the river to the sea," a popular slogan at protests for Palestinian rights, as a call for the, quote, "eradication of the state of Israel and the Jewish people," unquote. Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian-American Congress member, wrote, quote, "opposing the policies of the government of Israel and Netanyahu's extremism is not anti-Semitic. Speaking up for human rights and a ceasefire to save lives should never be condemned," she said. This comes amidst a mounting offensive by AIPAC, that's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, to unseat progressives who speak up for Palestinian rights. Earlier today, Westchester County Executive George Latimer, who's been courted by AIPAC, announced he's launching a primary challenge against New York Congressmember Jamal Bowman. Last month, two Michigan Democrats running for the U.S. Senate revealed AIPAC offered them $20 million to instead primary Congressmember Tlaib for her House seat. Nasser Beydoun, a Lebanese-American businessman, and Hill Harper, a Hollywood actor-turned-politician, both turned AIPAC down. Meanwhile, a new book by journalist Ryan Grimm reports an AIPAC representative approached Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with an offer to raise $100,000 after her stunning 2018 win. The fundraising was presented as an opening salvo to, quote, "start the conversation about AOC's position on Israel." The UN Monday heard accounts of sexual assaults during Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel. Speakers criticized the UN and others for failing to promptly investigate and condemn sexual crimes. Former Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg, who helped organize the event, was a key speaker. Hillary Clinton sent videotaped remarks. President Biden Tuesday condemned Hamas for the alleged attacks, which the group has denied. The nonprofit Physicians for Human Rights Israel last month released a report detailing survivor accounts of sexual assaults, which it said were widespread on October 7th. This is Orit Soliciano, head of Israel's Association of Rape Crisis Centers.
Most of the people, I assume, that have passed this kind of terror are dead because they were shot. There is information from people who saw what happened, but everybody should understand there should not be any anticipation that the survivors will come and speak out loud with their face. It's not like Me Too. This is a horrible and different thing.
Here in the United States, 400 military nominees were swiftly confirmed by the Senate Tuesday, just hours after Alabama Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville lifted his 10-month blockade on the majority of appointments. Tuberville had been protesting a completely unrelated Pentagon policy that pays out-of-state travel costs for its staff to receive abortion care. He finally relented after mounting pressure from fellow Republicans and threats from Democrats to temporarily change Senate rules in order to bypass the blockade. In related news, the military's top sexual assault prosecutor has been fired after an email surfaced in which he undermined assault allegations of survivors. Brigadier General Warren Wells sent the email to staff in 2013, which read in part, expect no commander to be able to make objective decisions involving allegations as long as Congress and our political masters are dancing by the fire of misleading statistics and one-sided, repetitive misinformation by those with an agenda, he said. In Texas, a pregnant woman has filed an emergency lawsuit seeking to terminate her non-viable pregnancy. 31-year-old Kate Cox is 20 weeks pregnant with a fetus that's been diagnosed with trisomy 18, a fatal condition, but is unable to get the abortion she needs due to Texas's sweeping abortion ban. It's the first legal complaint filed in Texas since the ban was enacted and reads, quote, Ms. Cox's physicians have informed her that their hands are tied and she will have to wait until her baby dies inside her or carry the pregnancy to term, at which point she will be forced to have a third C-section only to watch her baby suffer until death. In Nigeria, President Bola Tinubu ordered an investigation following a miscalculated military drone strike that killed at least 85 civilians Sunday in the village of Tudunbiri in the northwest Kaduna state. The victims were gathering for a religious celebration marking the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad. This is a survivor recounting the tragic attack.
We were celebrating Maulud when the airplane came and dropped the bomb. Some died, some got injured, and we all ran into the house. When the men in the village heard what happened, they came out to check, and that was when they dropped the second one, and more people died.
Drones are estimated to have erroneously killed some 400 civilians since 2017 in attacks that were targeting armed groups in the north of Nigeria. And Honduran authorities have issued an arrest warrant for the suspected mastermind of the 2016 murder of indigenous environmental leader Berta Cáceres. Daniela Tala Midense is the former financial manager of the hydroelectric company DESA. Berta Cáceres was assassinated as she led the fight against DESA's massive hydroelectric dam on a river in southwestern Honduras that's sacred to the Lenca people. Last year, David Castillo, a former U.S.-trained Honduran military officer and businessman, was sentenced to over 22 years for his role in ordering and planning Berta's assassination. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the U.N. Climate Summit in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. We begin today's show in Gaza. As Israeli tanks are moving into the center of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, after days of intense shelling and airstrikes. Palestinian health officials say the death toll in Gaza has topped 16,200, including over 6,600 children. This is a resident of Khan Yunis speaking after Israel bombed his home.
There were 30 people inside the house. 20 of them were children. Children aged 15 days, 1 year, 3 years, 4 years. We set up a place for them to sleep throughout the bombardment. We put them to sleep. We went to sleep. All of a sudden, what happened to us, we don't know. The fire hit us, and like you see, all of it collapsed on top of us. None of us made it out completely okay. Everybody is hurt. How and why? We don't even understand what happened ourselves. We rushed to the hospitals to check on the children and came back this morning to check the house. Look at this. I swear, we don't even know how we made it out alive.
On Tuesday, Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, released a statement saying, quote, the pulverizing of Gaza now ranks amongst the worst assaults on any civilian population in our time and age. Each day, we see more dead children and new depths of suffering for the innocent people enduring this hell, he said. We're joined now by Yousef Hamash, advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's joining us today from Rafah. Yousef, thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about what's happening right now from Khan Yunis, where you were, to Rafah, where you have fled now.
Thanks for hosting me, Amy. Unfortunately, after 7 days of the humanitarian pause, we weren't expecting that we will see this madness getting increased the madness is getting bigger and bigger. And after, directly after the humanitarian blows, the bombing started mainly in the south, and the Israeli land operations started taking place in Khan Yunis, and they turned Gaza into three pieces. While it used to be cut into two parts, now it's three parts. So we have Gaza City and the middle area, and Khan Yunis and Rafah. And as the ground operation started eastern part of Khan Yunis, and they asked the residents to flee to Rafah. That's what forced us to flee for the third time now to Rafah. And hundreds of thousands of people had to do this, to take this choice to flee into Rafah and to build these small tents made by wooden sticks and plastic under this harsh weather. And it became really crazy situation suddenly. And we had to witness the same as we witnessed in the northern part of Gaza when the military operation, even the war started at 12, after the war started in 12th of October, when they asked us to flee to the south. And we didn't have other option, and we fled to the south, to Khan Yunis, and now we found ourselves doing it again. Hopefully it's going to be the last time. Unfortunately, the humanitarian situation is catastrophic here. People are using any place as a shelter. People living on sidewalks and streets and any empty area, they found it, they put anything to cover their heads, and they consider it as a shelter without any means of protection. And it's a horrible situation that I don't think I have the ability to describe it. If you see it by your own eyes, you'll be shocked. We never witnessed such horror. And you can see it in people's face. They are in a miserable situation, doesn't have any option to do. All what they do is looking for their safety, fleeing from a place to another place.
Yusuf, it's not usual in most situations where the journalists themselves are trying to save their own families and their own lives as you report on the entire situation. If you can track your own journey with your family, I think some 60 journalists, Gazan Palestinian journalists, about that number have been killed in these last weeks, including the head of the Gaza Journalists Association, so many cameramen and reporters. But if you can start with your journey, where you left first north and then going home to Jabalia and go from there, and why in each situation the terror and the destruction that you left behind.
So at the beginning of the, on 7th of October, I had to flee my house because I live in Beit Lahia, which is more near to the border. And usually, based on our previous experience from wars and escalation, it's the first areas to be targeted, and I thought it's better for me to take my children and my extended family to Jabalia camp, which is the center of the north, convincing myself that it's going to be a bit more safe. And we, since the moment that I did this decision, I left everything behind. I didn't care what I'm going to lose. I was looking for the safety of my family. Two, 3 days after the war, my house was targeted, then my parents' house was targeted, and the other house of my brother was targeted. And on the 12th of, I had to stay in my grandparents' house in Jabalia, and the 12th of October, we start to receive these phone calls from Israelis and settlers just threatening us and warning us about what's coming. And then I had to decide to flee again from Jabalia to the south, based on what they ask us. And again, our responsibility towards our children and our extended families forced us to take these options. We fled to Khan Yunis without anything, literally. We had to start our new life. And I was lucky because I have some relatives there, so I managed to find a roof to cover my head. And I wasn't expecting that we will live this horror again, and we had to take this option again for the third time to go to Rafah. But unfortunately, in Rafah, we don't have that option to have a roof to cover our heads. And since 2 days, I'm trying, surfing around the Rafah, looking for any place to shelter my family. And unfortunately, until now, I didn't succeed to find a place. Today, I had to go to build a tent for my family, finding a safe place, as they call it in El Mawasi area, that's going to be much safe there. And We follow what's the instruction that what we receive, and I had to do the same as other hundreds, thousands of other people in Gaza who had to take that option also. So I had to build a tent. I don't know how we will manage to fit in it, but this is the option that we have. And but especially the 2 days when the military operation started in Khan Yunis, the horror that we saw from the bombardment, the non-stopping bombardment. I was calculating for the timing between each missile was 8 seconds. Imagine we were living in an earthquake. And that's what, again, always putting us in a situation in front of our children that we are useless to protect them. We cannot even provide protection for our children and my sisters, for example. I felt very, very useless in front of them because I cannot do anything for them. So we had to take that option, convincing ourselves again that we will be safe. I'm pretty sure there is no place safe in Gaza, but we'll do I will take whatever it takes. I'll do it to protect my family.
Now, you're not a journalist. You're an aid worker. You are an advocacy officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. But your descriptions of what is happening there are so critical. How do you do your work and the other 50 or so Norwegian Refugee Council workers do their work in Gaza as they're being forced to flee? And are you trying to get now over the border from Rafah into Egypt?
Yeah, we are trying to do our best because this is our role and this is why we are here. But unfortunately, we are in the same situation like everyone's here. During the humanitarian pause, we were assessing the situation, trying to do distribution plan because we are trying to help as much as we can people in need. The majority of the entire population in Gaza are in need. So you have to understand the situation in general. Half of the population before 7th October was relying on humanitarian aid. Imagining adding this catastrophic situation to the need of people. The entire population in Gaza is in need. And if you combine us all as humanitarian actors, we cannot cover the need that we are having here. We use these 7 days to manage to have our trucks entered through Rafah and to do our distribution plan and trying to assist as much as we can. But then we found ourselves in this circle of violence again. And unfortunately, even in front of this situation now, we are useless. We cannot protect ourselves even as a humanitarian workers. There is no protection for any of us. We are all in Gaza under the same circumstances. We are trying, but the situation is preventing us. And trust me, many of my colleagues have to sleep in the streets.
Can you talk about what...
Sorry. Go ahead, Demi.
Can you talk about what kind of aid is getting through and isn't getting through? And what it means when you have something like 1.9 million Palestinians out of, 2.3 million who are on the run, who are internally displaced?
Honestly, Amy, what all of us as humanitarian actors can do is like a drop in the ocean of needs here. We keep asking for allowing more and more trucks of aid to enter, but it's too political, and everyone understands the situation now. They allow on a day, there is no even an accurate number for how many truck per day we can get through Rafah. It's too political situation, which is preventing us to understand. Trust me, in the past few days, we were chasing our trucks. We were trying to find solution how to get it through Rafah, manage it, store it in some place, then trying to distribute it as fast as we can because we understand it's nothing comparing to the need. So we are trying to do our best. Even if it was few people that we can assist and help, it is something. But even to reach that small something is not easy. It's almost impossible because of the situation that we are living in. The amount of aid that coming to Gaza is literally not tangible and is not affecting the need. It's not really affecting the amount of need that we are having in Gaza.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Youssef Hamash, Advocacy Officer in Gaza for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He fled Khan Yunis earlier this week, joining us now from Rafah. He was in Beit Lahia originally, fled to the Jabalia refugee camp, then to Khan Yunis, then to Rafah near the border crossing with Egypt. Coming up, Democracy Now! Attempts to question the head of the UAE state oil company who is presiding over the UN climate summit. Stay with us. طول علينا الليل قولي صباح الخير بيجي النهار يطل يا حبيبتي الكل بكرة يجينا نهار ما في تعب أو ثار بكرة في الأصغر الشمس وتمر طول علينا الليل قولي صباح الخير يجي النهار يطل يا حبيبتي كل Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Dubai, here in the United Arab Emirates. The president of the Climate Summit, UAE oil CEO Sultan Al Jaber, is facing ongoing criticism for his recent comments claiming there's no science to back up calls to phase out fossil fuels in order to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. During a recent Zoom call with former Irish President Mary Robinson and others, Sultan Al Jaber said a full phase out of fossil fuels would, quote, take the world back into caves.
There is no science out there or no scenario out there that says that the phase out of fossil fuel is what's going to achieve 1.5. 1.5 is my North Star. Please help me, show me a roadmap for a phase out of fossil fuel that will allow for sustainable socioeconomic development, unless you want to take the world back into caves.
Those were the words of Sultan Al Jaber, the president of this year's climate summit, and yes, the CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company called ADNOC. His comments directly contradict those of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who says a phase out of fossil fuel is a critical step.
The science is clear. The 1.5 degree limit is only possible if we ultimately stop burning all fossil fuels. Not reduce, not abate, phase out with a clear time frame aligned with 1.5 degrees.
On Tuesday, the UN Climate Summit President, Sultan Al Jaber, held a town hall meeting just behind me inside the UN Climate Summit here in Dubai. We attempted to get in right after our show, but we were told the press wasn't allowed inside. I tried to ask him a question on the way in. We were then directed to an overflow room buildings away, but raced back to try to question Sultan Al Jaber as he left the town hall meeting. Dr. Al Jaber, do you believe in a fossil fuel phase-out?
Yes.
Can you answer a question from the press? Dr. Al Jaber, can you tell us why there are 2,500 fossil fuel lobbyists here? Dr. Al Jaber, can you tell us if there should be a fossil fuel phase-out? Dr. Al Jaber, one question. I can't keep up with you.
He's on call, madam. He's on call.
It's okay. It's okay. I know. He's doing his job. I'm doing mine.
Please come to the press conference, please.
When is the press conference?
Tomorrow.
What time?
They will let you know. Please. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Congratulations. You are a strong lady.
Come to the press conference, please.
Okay.
I will, but I'm going to try to get an answer here. Okay, I will come to the press.
Please, please, thank you.
Dr. Al-Jaber, could you just answer one question from the press? Dr. Al-Jaber, one question from the press. People want to know why there are a record number of fossil fuel lobbyists at this conference.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me.
No, stop, no, please. No press at this press. No press, please. No press at this press. Thank you.
Okay. Okay.